heard this question asked to me once, did the dinosaurs go in the ark, or why didn't they survive that way?
Okay, yeah, this is a question, it's not a bad one, about dinosaurs and the ark. The point is, yes, I believe dinosaurs did go on the ark. And the problem is, people have the wrong impression of the ark, which is quite destructive. I'll just get this slide on for you. That is the wrong picture. This bathtub ark is just ridiculous, because I'd rather see that these pictures banned from kids' books. What you're doing with this picture is giving the kids a false impression, when you could use the biblical dimensions of 500 cubits long. This is a cubit, elbow to fingertip, say 18 inches conservatively. You're talking about an ark that could hold over 500 railroad carriages, and each of those carriages could hold 250 sheep. It's a huge vessel. You look at how it compares to the big lorries on the road. You see how tiny humans are compared to the real ark. It's also got amazing dimensions. It would have been incredibly stable. Even a tsunami near the shore couldn't have knocked this thing over with that sort of dimension. That's what the Korean naval architects have worked out. Now, when you're talking about dinosaurs, though, yes, certainly dinosaurs were a big thing. Oh, thank you, Jim. Thank you. They were big. There are a lot of small ones too. But the main thing is there probably weren't that many dinosaur kinds as there were. Because people think of... remember the dogs I showed you last time, right? You've got a small variety... you've got parents which have all the genetic information to give quite a lot of different varieties of dogs. I think the same thing would have happened with dinosaurs. A few created kinds, but lots of varieties within that. You see, for instance, take the sauropods, you see, these are the big ones, but you look at the skulls of, say, Apatosaurus and Diplodocus, they're almost the same, I think they're the same kind of animal. I think this Diplodocus was just a very long and skinny version of the same kind of creature. And the thing is, Noah would have only had to take on a representative of that kind, not every single dinosaur name. Also, we've found that it's either some dinosaur names were really juvenile versions of other ones, like Musaurus, which means mouse lizard, seems to be a baby Coloradosaurus. So you have a few of those things. And here's a case where three different dinosaur names, Dracorex, Stegomoloch, and Pachycephalosaurus, seem to be different stages of the same creature. And also, even the Torosaurus seems to be a mature version of a Triceratops, only discovered this year. So again, you only have to take these one pair of what represents both of these creatures, because they're the same kind of creature. So there's plenty of room for all the dinosaurs on an ark as big as that. And some dinosaurs were quite small too. Lesothosaurus and Troodon, Compsognathus and Coelophysa were very small dinosaurs. The Velociraptor was actually only half the size they showed on Jurassic Park. And even the big dinosaurs started off as itty-bitty dinosaurs. No bigger than the egg was no bigger than a football. And we also found, looking at growth rings and dinosaur bones, they went through a sort of teenage growth spurt. You see here, here's the big one, you know, 25-ton Apatosaurus, been full-grown, but you see, at the age of four, he was about 1 ton. You see, if God is the one who brought the animals to Noah, he brings a 1-ton four-year-old, and when it's 5 years old and gets ready to disembark a year later, it's still not very big, but only after the ark does it go through its growth spurt. So when you consider all these things, the huge size of the ark, the relatively few number of dinosaur kinds, and the fact that Noah didn't have to take the full-grown creatures on, there's no problem fitting all the animals on the ark at all. Okay? Who's got another question? Me on this side. Yeah, please.
Could you maybe provide a list of some of the most compelling evidence that refutes the ape-human evolution?
Oh, the ape-human evolution. What I recommend is one of the we've got some DVDs about ape-human. Now, one thing about it, it seems that even when I was going to school, they were telling us that Ramapithecus was an ancestor of humans. Now they believe it's an ancestor of orangutans. You know, when my boss was going, it was very young, the National Geographic had this creature called Zinjanthropus boisei, the nutcracker man. as an ancestor. Now, they don't believe that was an ancestor. So many times, these so-called human ancestors are now, have now been put onto this side branch. But also, the main thing, there's a few things different about humans and apes, and they talk about, say, 98% similarity or whatever, whoever's telling the story, but with 3 billion letters, even a 2% difference, you're talking about 60 million letter changes to go from an ape to a human. And then you've got to explain things like the language ability and our thinking ability, because I guarantee that no ape will be asking this question. Okay, one on the side then.
I just have 2 questions for you. First of all, you'd mentioned something about the Ice Age, so I'm just wondering what your feelings on the Ice Age is. And my second question is, as humans, we have 2 or 3 organs that we can perfectly live well without, like the appendix or tonsils and things like that. And I'm just wondering what your take on those are in terms of evolution.
Okay, that's a reasonably good question. By the way, the dinosaurs on the ark is a chapter in the Answers book, by the way. Dinosaurs is one chapter of the Answers book. Another chapter is about the Ice Age. So you see what I mean about the Answers book having the question? In fact, there's one chapter which talks about what are the arguments for evolution and includes these things like the appendix. But I'll just go through the Ice Age one for you first. Well, first of all, can you try to think, if you wanted to make an Ice Age, what do you think you'd have to do to the Earth? Well, that's what people think, but they're overlooking one thing. See, blocking out the sun would not be enough to produce an ice age. I'll show you what the ice age actually means, and you'll see what I mean, I hope. See, the ice age says that, you know, that Eurasia and North America were covered by gigantic ice sheets in the past. But you can tell from the glaciation mark, it's quite clear that we were once covered with ice in large areas. But how do you get ice onto the continents, though? You have to have snowfall, right? How do you get snowfall? You have to have clouds. Where do clouds come from? From evaporation. If you cooled down the whole Earth, you wouldn't have evaporation, so you would not get this sort of ice age from blocking out the sun. That would not be enough. But the flood, though, it says the fountains of the great deep burst forth. And when you think of subterranean water and lava pouring into the ocean, that would warm the ocean, so you got this warmth, the evaporation, you got plenty of evaporation going on, but volcanic eruptions also would block out sunlight. See, when Krakatoa erupted, these huge eruptions, they've been known that the Earth's temperature drops a bit with the ash in the atmosphere. So this is the perfect condition for forming an ice age right after the flood of Noah's day. And eventually the oceans would cool off and the ash would dissipate and therefore the world would warm up and dry out a bit as well. And it's toward the end of the Ice Age where woolly mammoth fossils were formed. I think the woolly mammoth fossils we have were not formed during the flood, but towards the end of the Ice Age, buried by catastrophic dust storms. So this is basically a brief picture of how a single ice age happened after the flood. And rather than lots of ice age, there were sort of advanced retreat stages of the same ice age, which had been misinterpreted as multiple ice age. Now, the other question was things like the appendix. Why do we have an appendix? Well, it's very interesting. Recent research has shown that the appendix is a safe house for the good bacteria in your gut. You know, you might take probiotics. They are basically good bacteria. But you see, when you have intestinal upset, you flush those good bacteria down away. And what the appendix does is store the good bacteria so they can repopulate the bowels. This is an important function just discovered. And also, it doesn't fit the evolutionary pattern. They realize that, in fact, appendix appears in quite a lot of different creatures, and it has no relation to the supposed evolutionary history. It just doesn't fit the evolution picture. So if you want to look on our website, gocreation.com/appendix. You also go to creation.com/appendix2 for another article, appendix 3 for another article, appendix 4 for another one. Okay, so there's several articles about different aspects of the appendix. It also has lymphatic tissue. Like your tonsils are not useless, you see. You can survive without them. It doesn't mean that it's not good to have, though, because the lymphatic tissue in the tonsil is good for fighting infections on the top half, and the appendix has some lymphatic tissue for fighting infections in the bottom half. of your alimentary canal. So you can do without them, but doctors now know that they try not to remove tonsils unless they really have to. See, as frontline soldiers, they can get the first casualties in a war against an infection. Now, I think a lot of the problem with appendicitis these days is because of the Western diet. It's not a very good diet, really, the Western diet. And that, I think in other countries, appendicitis is not such a problem as it is in the Western culture. Okay, this side.
Yeah, could you comment on carbon dating? Apparently it's about accurate to maybe perhaps 10,000 years, and in reflection of argon dating, which evolutionists like to lean into for an old Earth, is carbon dating still the true measure? Is argon any good for that?
Okay, actually, chapter 4 of this book has the carbon-14 dating and radiometric dating. Now, I want to give you a little illustration of all dating methods. And by dating methods, I'm not talking about boys meeting girls. I'm talking about how old things are. So here is a dating method. I've got this measuring cylinder in my lab full of this green liquid, 300 mils of green liquid, and it's dropping in at 50 mils per hour. Question, how long did this take to fill? I think some people know are very good at arithmetic, I can tell, but in fact it's not the right answer because you assume that it started from zero. In fact, it started from 100. See, if you weren't there, you don't know where it started from. You have to make an assumption that it started from zero, but if you're not there, that is all it is, an assumption. And also, when I'm in the chemistry lab, I'll turn the tap on full bore, and then when it gets close to the level, I'll drip it in so it gets up to the line where I want it, you see. So what you're seeing here is the dripping in. You're not seeing the full bore it was before. So once again, you made the assumption that the rate has been constant this whole time. That's all it is. And then you didn't notice that one of my students topped it up for me, too. You see, the other assumption you have to make is that nothing else got in or out of the system. You see, that's the problem with all dating methods, including the radioactive dating method. Because, I mean, what the radioactive dating method does is measure amounts of chemicals in rocks. That's where the science ends. But then they have to make this assumption nothing else got in or out of the system. You know, where did it start from? You know, anything else got in or out? Has the rate been constant? Now, it's interesting to know about carbon-14, though. I'll show you some interesting things. See, carbon-14 decays very quickly. It's got a half-life of 5,700 years, roughly. And that means after one half-life, there's only half of the stuff left. After two half-lives, there's a quarter left. After three, there's an eighth left. You see how it goes on? It's an exponential decay. So do the calculations. You can work out that if the whole Earth was pure carbon-14, it couldn't last a million years. It would all have gone. Yet we're finding over and over again, we find carbon-14 in coal, which is mostly carbon. But see, coal was supposed to have formed hundreds of millions of years ago. So carbon-14 shouldn't be there. And diamonds are supposed to have formed over a billion years ago. Now, diamond is just a form of carbon. Yet these diamonds have carbon-14 in them. And since diamond is the hardest substance around, except for the human heart, it couldn't be contaminated. So if you have carbon-14 in diamonds, you know, how could they have been around for billions of years? Because the carbon-14 will have all disintegrated by then. So carbon-14 is actually an ally of the biblical model, not an enemy. And I wrote a little article in our Creation magazine called Diamonds, a Creationist's Best Friend, which is now available on our website. Just a little overview of dating methods and hopefully carbon-14 as an ally of the biblical timescale. Yes, sir.
I have a question concerning adding information to the genome.
Yeah.
I think I agree with that, and it's true when we observe any real examples in nature. But I'm wondering concerning... I read your book, The Greatest Hoax on Earth, and you were talking about Lenski's experiment, and you also referenced Michael Behe's book, The Edge of Evolution. I'm wondering, in a theoretical scenario, like if you have a frameshift mutation or a gene duplication, yes, where you have the original gene and a copy of it, couldn't theoretically you get some mutations that would add information. So I'm wondering, should there be some sort of condition to that claim based on...
Okay, so what this gentleman's talking about is a question that people come up with. You see, there are times that you have a gene which is copied. That's what you're saying? And then somehow this copied gene mutates into something else useful. So where you had one gene, you got two genes. So supposedly you got two lots of information where you had in your one. That's sort of what I'm trying to say, what you're saying there?
Yes.
Okay, now, the problem is, you see, a mutated gene is not going to do very well, you see. When you have a copy of the 21st chromosome, you have Down syndrome because you're getting an imbalance in something there. So the scenario seems to be that you copy this gene and somehow this gene is switched off. And it's switched off, then natural selection's not working on it, so it's free to vary, and then somehow the gene is switched on to produce something else, and then natural selection takes over again. So you've got quite a lot of scenarios involved to try to make gene duplication become the engine of evolution. My second book, Refuting Evolution 2, covers a bit of the gene duplication idea. And creation.com has a few articles on the gene duplication, whether it actually is something that can save evolution. I don't think it can. Okay.
I was just wondering, though, should there be some sort of condition on that claim based on, like, probabilistic resources or something?
Mm-hmm. The condition, you see, I don't want to say that information can never go uphill, because, I mean, as you rightly say, the information is a measure of probability, but it's a case of there are many more ways of breaking something than making something. You see, there's a probability, if I saw my name written in sand, there's a probability that wind and water erosion could do it, but it's actually so tiny that it makes more sense to use a designer as an explanation. Same with mutation, there is a small probability of getting a tiny amount of information. But when you talk about how do you build things like this motor, when you've got lots of different changes all together, it doesn't really work. So for all practical purposes, you can say the information is going downhill and almost never uphill. And in fact, even the examples that are presented of uphill mutation seem to be very debatable. And yet most of the examples evolutionists present to us are clearly examples of downhill mutations. I can go through a few of those if you want to. Okay, well, thanks for that. I'm going to go to the other side, sir. Other side?
Yes.
Got to be fair to both of you. Right wing and left wing, okay?
All right. I have a problem finding a sound case coming from the young earth creationists on the internet and anywhere I search. Generally, I keep finding resources that keep trying to refute things, refute evolution, refute older theories. And what I'm looking for, what I want to find, is some peer-reviewed publications in scientific journals from young earth creationists so that there's a little bit of credibility there that also shows the ability to cooperate with the global community.
Well, okay, this is really a question about peer review, isn't it? Is a question sort of like, well, if we're real scientists, why don't we publish in the peer-reviewed journals? That's the sort of thing that you're trying to ask there?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, but the thing is, on our website, we've got an article about peer review and documenting how peer review can actually be a gatekeeper preventing challenges to the establishment. We see it also with this global warming thing. We remember the ClimateGate scandals where you have emails revealing how some of these global warming propagandists have said, well, we are going to use peer review to suppress the contrary evidence. We're going to try and hide the decline. We have evidence of peer review rejecting work which later won the Nobel Prize. We have peer review accepting things which have been proven to be fraudulent. So I think peer review is a little bit overrated.
Well,
that's the thing. But the thing is, I'd say that our journals are also peer reviewed too. See, nothing that we write on our website ever goes without being checked by other PhD scientists. So you've got PhD scientists reviewing all our information. But if it means going to the establishment journals, who have often said explicitly, we will not publish anything that supports creationism. So they'll say, creation's not science because it's not peer-reviewed, it's not published in peer-reviewed journals, but we're not going to publish it in peer-reviewed journals because it's not science. You see, so you can't win against the circular reasoning.
Are any of your peer reviews done by non-creationists?
Well, I mean, how many evolutionary papers are reviewed by creationists?
Why is there the need for that divide? That's like the biggest problem I have.
But the thing is, I mean, the nature doesn't ask a creationist every time they write something against creation or pro-evolution. So, well, why do we need to do the same? I mean, I'm presenting the evidence. Let's you try to take it down. That's ain't fair.
I think
peer review is almost like an excuse not to deal with the arguments.
It does demonstrate an ability to work with people that share different views.
But is there a different view when the evolutionary establishment is totally materialistic and has explicitly stated we are not going to publish work that supports intelligent design or creation?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by...
when you got journals which make it very clear that they're not going to publish creationist promoting material, we are not going to waste the time submitting to those journals.
Are all of them like that, or is that just a few? Few journals?
Quite a lot. I mean, even some obscure journals who actually did publish some intelligent design supporting paper got so much flack. I mean, the editor was basically fired, and the flack they got for actually daring to publish this anti-evolutionary paper, I mean, I think a lot of other journal editors would run scared of trying to do that.
I'm sure.
That's why we publish our own journals.
I'm sure that money's at stake here for a lot of people.
Oh,
but,
money?
Actually, I'd like to get back.
That's
to
very interesting.
Point.
I must have sold that for the lowest bidder then.
I'd like to get back to your original question I had.
Yeah.
Is like those other journals that would be open to creationist publications. Do you know which ones those are? And
I'm
are
not sure myself.
Not sure at all.
I publish. That's why we have our own things. Because a lot of what we do, you see, you've got certain data. See, the data belongs to everyone, but it's how you interpret the data. You see, and a lot of my articles have been taking other people's data and showing how I think it actually fits better with the creation model than their evolutionary model. You see, that's the thing. Once the data is produced, it belongs to everyone. That's the beauty of science, isn't it? That data can be shared, but their interpretation might be different from mine.
But shouldn't it be possible to interpret the data independent of theistic views?
Oh, but it doesn't really happen that way, though.
I know that Einstein said that science without religion is lame, and religion without science is blind or whatnot.
I think you said something of that. Yes, I've heard that.
Yeah, but I think that the data, and if you're going to look at it rationally and logically, that should actually reconcile with what God has created.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm interested in knowing if there are scientists who are open to, atheist scientists who are open to young earth creationist theories, and creationist scientists that are open to evolutionary theories, mm-hmm. and are able to demonstrate working together in an interest to find out what the actual facts are. Right.
Might be nice, I admit, but I mean, so the thing is, a lot about us were once atheistic scientists. So a lot of us have been there, done that. So, I mean, that's the thing, so a lot of us have actually understood the atheist case, and we really don't believe it anymore. We don't think it fits the facts. But I better move on to another question, if that's all right.
I'm going to thank you for your time. I'm going to let some other people ask.
Well, I appreciate
questions.
It. Thanks
thank
for
you,
coming.
Thank you, Dr. Sir Fatty.
Thank you. Yes, sir, please.
Could you comment, please, on the design of the ankle?
Of the which, sorry?
The ankle.
Ankle? Why? I am not an expert in anatomy, I'm sorry. Why?
No. Well, I keep twisting it, but I never need medical help for it. And
I'm sorry to hear that.
Understand why that is.
I couldn't answer that. I know a bit more about the knee joint. The knee joint is another thing which gets attacked, and yet my book, By Design, covers why the knee joint is actually an extremely good design, but I'm afraid the ankle joint is something a bit beyond me. I'm sorry I can't be much more help to you. About. I wish you all the best in recovery. Anyway. Yeah. Yes, sir.
I'll try and make this as quick as possible. It's something that over a few years I've been looking at. The idea of an inland sea or a large lake in the center of what we would call the Great Plains, I guess in the States and Canada. The mooring stones that they found all through Minnesota and along the upper northeastern areas through there. I spent some time with the Navajo, and they were talking about back in their ancient history about a huge earthquake in the plateau that the Grand Canyon became and how that inland lake blew through it, and then they inhabited that canyon. Like, is there anybody that's done any...
I would like to see that myself. I mean, I'd be very interested in that myself, yeah, if I could see it documented. That sounds very fascinating.
Has anybody... plausible.
I've not heard of it, but it's plausible. I would like to know more about it myself. That'd be very interesting if we could document it.
So there's nothing that you know of in the way of creationist, young Earth study?
Not myself. That's the thing. I mean, when we publish stuff on the website, I'd like to also see that it's documented. But it may well be true. I don't want to say you're right or wrong, but I would like to know myself.
Yeah, these are just kind of evidences, you know, whether it's anthropologically or geologically, you know, and like you kind of put it all together and was it there?
Well, it'd be nice. I mean, I would be quite interested in that.
Okay, so you know of no one that's studied that or done a book on it?
I guess there's so many. I mean, what I do understand that is that every culture in the world has a flood legend. That's an interesting one. You see, even a scientist who works with the Amazonian natives in South America says that she couldn't find a culture, one of those cultures, who didn't have a legend of a global flood, which is very interesting. It seems to indicate that every culture on the earth has descended from people who survived a global flood.
Yeah, this was more of an inland lake or an inland
sea
that was
I
flames.
Think so. I don't know much about it, sorry.
After the Ice Age, I guess. And
that would fit the Ice Age, yes.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't know more about it. I'm sorry, I can't help you there, sir. Sorry. Oh, yes, sir.
Hi. My question is just about the time of the flood. I was wondering when the salt water and the fresh water mix during the flood. And then the waters are seeded. How did it sort itself up?
Okay, that's a question. That's a chapter of the answers before that, you know. One chapter all about how fresh water and salt water fish survived the flood. And the thing is, fresh water is less dense than salt water, so fresh water floats on top for quite a long time. And they talk about a halo climb, where you've got different salinities in the sea, different line salinity concentrations throughout the sea, a halo climb. And the reason salt water is denser is because of something called electrostriction. That's in my field of chemistry, because the ions attract the polar water molecules to themselves. That's why the salt water is more compact than fresh water. That's one very major thing. The different layers could persist for quite some time. Also, when it comes to fish, freshwater and saltwater fish, they, in an aquarium, the underwater world in Queensland, where I was living, they actually had a freshwater fish and a saltwater fish in the same aquarium. So how did they manage to do that? Well, the answer is they acclimatized them gradually to the different salinities. You see, if you did it suddenly, you'd kill the fish if you exposed them to a sudden change, but if you did it gradually, they can acclimatize. And also, I think some of the differences are the specialization, just much like the difference between the short fur and long fur dogs coming from the same thing. I think same salt water and fresh water tolerance is also a specialization, so which is why you can have salt water and fresh water varieties of the same kind of fish. So I think there's not too much of a way of a problem there. Okay? Side, please.
Where are you going with this information? Do you hope to have creation science taught in the schools?
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. I mean, I'd rather... You know, my personal opinion is that we should separate school and state. See, I'm not about compulsion. I don't want to have laws compelling anything to happen. I'm objecting to the law that compels you to furnish tax dollars for a state education that teaches anti-Christian propaganda, whether you use it or not. Okay, this is like, we are not a lobby group. We've made it very clear. We are not a lobby group to push creation science. And anyway, think of our self-interest. Why would we want an atheist teaching creation science and distorting it and trying to make it look silly? There's no reason for us to want to push it. That's not our game at all, okay?
Could you comment on the three highly publicized court cases in the United States that declared creation science and intelligent design are not science and could not be taught in the classroom?
Okay, well, why should we accept... what does a judge know about what science is? He's not qualified. Why should I care? I'm a scientist. The judge, John Jones, is not a scientist. What he says doesn't mean a thing to me. I mean, there's this judge who ruled with the Dover Creation trial. Well, his main claim to fame before that was a really not a very distinguished career on the liquor board. That was his claim to fame. He's appointed a judge. And he knows he could get a very high name for himself by ruling against the creation science. Then he becomes the darling of the media and Time and has a lecture circuit because he ruled against the design thing. But what he did, he just parroted the ACLU submission. He wasn't nothing profound found in what he said. He just took the ACLU side, the anti-Christian side, and ran with it. But I mean, why should I care what a judge thinks? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, does he care what I think about law? I don't think so.
So you're saying all three judges were prejudiced?
Yeah, of course.
I see. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for being here tonight. We all appreciate it, I think. I appreciate your bravery, sir, that's for sure. And I would like to ask what your top three scientific evidences would be for a young Earth.
For a young Earth?
And one other thing, sorry. And how you can qualify a large universe and a young Earth coexisting.
I mean, you're talking about distant starlights. Are you talking about that? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Well, okay, I mean, my book, The Greatest Hope, I cover some evidences for a young Earth. I think one of them, I think, is the preservation of things like the dinosaur soft tissue, which really puts an upper limit on how old these things could be. And if they're found in rocks supposedly 65 million years old, that puts very much a time frame on those dinosaur rocks. And these aren't the only organic things which have been preserved. Like, they found squid ink, you know, the ink sank, and they could still write with the ink, you know. So I think that's one thing I had was the preservation of organic material from supposedly millions of years old. I think the radiocarbon in diamond and coal is a very strong one as well. Another one I think is quite a good one is the issue of comets, because comets, you know, they're dirty snowball. They come past the sun and the sun evaporates some of the stuff and the solar wind blows it out into a couple of tails pointing away from the sun. So each time it comes past, it's losing mass. But then you work out that they shouldn't be around for more than about 10,000 years at the most. You see, so the existence of comets seems to be very strong evidence against a big age of the solar system. Okay, so there are a few things out there, but just look at my books there. Greatest Hoaxes is got my latest take on the evidence for a young Earth. As for distant starlight, well, that's in the Answers book, Chapter 5. So you get the point that I've got a lot of, the Answers book does cover a lot of things. Now, I want to point out that no matter what position you take, you are going to have a problem with light travel time. I'll show you what I'm talking about. You see, the Big Bangers have a problem with light travel time. I'll explain what the Big Bang is saying. The Big Bang says that nothing exploded and became everything. So what you have, you've got these points at different temperatures when the Big Bang happened. But when you look now, you have the cosmic microwave background, which points to a background temperature which is uniform throughout the universe, 3 degrees above absolute zero. But it's uniform to within one part in 100,000. The problem is, even under, if you assume a Big Bang age of the universe, there's not enough time for light to have equilibrated the temperature. You see, to equalize temperature, you must have energy going from hot to cold. And the fastest this can happen is the speed of light. But there's just nowhere near, there's far too little time for light to travel. This is the furthest it could travel, yet these two points are at the same temperature. And they call this the horizon problem, because this is actually the horizon. And then you think about the way the evolutionists have tried to get around this, you see, because there's no point pointing the finger at creationists for having a light travel problem, because there's three fingers pointing back at themselves for having the same problem, see. If it's a problem for both sides, it's a problem for neither side. Well, it can't be used to compare the two. And here's one person, Joao Maguejo, who wants to say that light was much faster in the past, you know, 60 orders of magnitude faster near the Big Bang, to try to explain this horizon problem. You see, when creationists thought of light being much faster in the past in the 1970s, I don't think I believe that myself, but they were accused of being scientific heretics. How dare you say speed of light has changed, but now they're doing exactly the same thing to explain the Big Bang. Or you have Alan Guth's idea of inflation. Inflation says that about 10 to the minus 35th power seconds after the Big Bang, the universe expanded by a factor of 10 to the 25th. In a 10 to the minus 30th of a second. So it's an incredibly fast expansion or inflation of the universe, much faster than light. So again, they're talking about faster than light inflation of space to get around the horizon problem. But they have no way, physical way, of starting this inflation or stopping this inflation. See, that's what I mean. The Big Bangers have their own light travel problem. I think the solution, if you want to know, it's just like the Answers Book, Chapter 5, is one place you'll find a simple solution. If you want to know a bit more, you can look at this book called Starlight, Time, and the New Physics by a tenured professor of physics in the University of Western Australia who's published work in astrophysical journals, and he uses some of his work to explain how, measured by Earth clocks, light could have traveled from the distant stars and galaxies to reach us in the 6 days, within the 6 days of creation, as measured by Earth clocks, anyway. There's a thing you have to say, when you talk about time frame, you have to say according to which clock. You see, clocks vary in how fast they go. Gravity slows down time. Your GPS satellites have to take into account this effect of gravity slowing down time, because the clocks and the GPS satellites work a bit faster, and you have to take this into account. But anyway, have a look at the book Starlight and Time and New Physics if you really want a detailed physical answer. Otherwise, just look at the Answers Book, Chapter 5. Okay. Okay, yes, ma'am.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming here. And personally, I'm an atheist. Mm-hmm. Watch his turn here. And I'm a science student. So I have been brought up with everything that's scientific. And religious faith is something that I very much would like to find. However, I find that I've learned quite a bit about the biblical interpretations of everything, the history on Earth. However, I find that most of your slides, I don't presume to understand the Big Bang Theory. Perhaps I need to get my PhD before I can do that, with all the intricacies and the math that's involved. However, the basic concepts, including everything from molecular biology to genetics to geology, carbon dating, everything there, I find that there are a lot of misrepresentations. First of all, science, of course, is a very complex enterprise. Everything is built one thing upon another. And to have a single slide represent decades of research of things that have been proven true by multiple people in multiple fields is to say that, look, this is just complete garbage, because it's an oversimplification, and for people to truly be able to openly judge what science is.
There's a question here, is it, Miss? Sorry, there is a question, right?
Well, my question is that I would like to ask that because we know about science, because molecular biology, because of medicine, we have made tremendous progress in the world in helping people.
Exactly.
However, how we arrived here is by assuming what we have assumed. By doing experiments, directly observing the world, instead of saying God has created everything, and we take that for face value, instead of looking into how the bodies work.
The thing is, this afternoon, I actually gave a talk where I talked about the origin of science and the difference between what you call operational science, which is how things work, as opposed to origins or history. You see, the great branches of science were founded by Bible-believing Christians who believed in a law-giving creator. It's because of an orderly this belief in a universe. It's belief in a law, in this law-giving creator, which led to modern science in the first place, while science was still born in places like Greece and China, because they didn't have this belief in a divine lawmaker and creator who upheld things in a regular, repeatable way. If you look at the origins of science, what you might call meta-science, which is the conditions required for science, in fact, the biblical viewpoint is very helpful for that. But also, the Bible tells us that God finished creating after day six. And therefore, what he's doing now is upholding his creation. And therefore, we can investigate the natural, what we might call natural laws of how he's doing that. I think it's how he's upholding it. But I would actually go for natural law explanation myself. I mean, I was a teaching assistant at university, and the question was about the spectral bands of an infrared spectral band of something. Why is it this way? And a student said, God made it that way. I marked him wrong for that. That's not a scientific explanation, okay? So, but when it comes to how do things originate, it's quite reasonable to look to a creator as an assumption. Or take my computer. I believe the computer works entirely by the processes of semiconductor physics, okay? And all that sort of material goes in the computer, okay? But this laws of semiconductor physics did not make the computer. So you see the difference there? God made things, but now they work by what we might call natural laws. So I think it's quite wrong to say the biblical view has been antithetical to science, because that's not the way it's been in history.
Well, I do recognize the value in religion, in starting the entire enterprise of science. However, science has gradually proven wrong several aspects that's within at least the traditional biblical views, or the original scientists have things like Earth-centered solar system, for example.
Okay, yeah, I've written on that part too.
Right.
I've written about a lot of these things. I mean, it's not new to me. But has it proven wrong about Earth-centered solar system? I mean, how much physics are you familiar with, for instance?
I have good physics. I've done 4 years of it.
4 years, but then you should know that all motion must be described by a reference frame.
Yes.
And Fred Hoyle said that the difference between the heliocentric and the geocentric view is just a matter of choice of reference frames. When you drive on the road, you might see a sign saying 60 kilometers per hour. What does that mean? It means relation to the Earth, doesn't it?
I'm not a historian. However, I do know that there are many evidence that that explicitly are wrong in the description of of an Earth-centric universe. But again,
Hang on, but the point is, if you don't mind, I mean, I wouldn't mind answering the question.
Okay.
But the thing is, the Bible uses the Earth as a reference frame, just as your speed limit signs do. Your speedometer in the car uses an Earth reference frame.
I understand what
do you ever say means. Sunset or sunrise?
Sorry?
Well, do you never use the word sunset or sunrise?
Sir, I understand the concept of relativity, and I know you're saying that if we are on Earth, then indeed we observe as if we are the center of the universe. That's perfectly fine. However, science has using mathematics and observations of many other things, which I'm sure you can refute as well, but I'm just saying that that's the past. And science, after more thinking and discovering, have found other explanations that have led to further correct predictions.
A lot of assertions there, but when your main assertion is actually just a matter of a choice of reference frame and not an error in the Bible at all. I mean, if we can say sunset and sunrise, why should we fault the Bible for using the same sort of language? There's no error there. And the people who say there really need to revise the idea of reference frames and relative motion.
It's hard to argue against this without using math, but unfortunately that's a problem with science that it's too complicated. Well, thank you very much for answering my questions. I guess I'll just have to search some more. And I suggest everybody, in addition to looking into creation science, look into real science and just to compare the two.
Oh, real science. Yeah. Okay. I mean, so my PhD is not real science. That's interesting, isn't it? Okay, notice how they poison the well here. This constant contrast between science and creationists, as though you can't be both, which I am, and which Sir Isaac Newton was, the greatest physicist of all time, Johann Kepler. You see, are you going to say that Kepler and Newton and Galileo, Faraday, Maxwell, Kelvin are not real scientists because they believed in creation?
By a bunch of people from a long time ago, which science still hasn't discovered. So I'm just saying that I don't have enough argument to prove this false. So I'm open to still exploring this, and I thank you for giving me this opportunity to learn from the Bible and from the people here. But
I don't think
I'm not convinced.
You're not going to be short of information about evolution. Let's face it. I mean, you can go to the university and the media. I am the other side. Okay.
I understand, and you're
yes.
up against a lot, so
yeah.
Thank you for being here.
That's all right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I just wanted to see if you can touch on the conundrum that we have in the formation of granite and mountains.
Of what, sorry?
The problem that scientists would have with polonium radiation rings that are in granite.
Yes, okay, yep.
So in science would say that granite takes millions of years to form, where evidence shows that it actually should happen in a couple of weeks to a month.
Okay. Well, what you're talking about is what you call radio halo evidence, and I cover that in my book, Refuting Compromise. And what this is, you've got microscopic flecks of radioactive material, and one type of radiation is called alpha radiation. That's sending out helium nuclei at a very fast, very energetic helium nuclei, and they eventually pick up electrons that become helium, but they discolor the rock in the process, you see. So they discolor the rock at the end of their path. Now, the path length depends on the energy. And if you've got a speck, it's going to shoot out radiation in all directions and form the sphere. And that sphere is called a radio halo. And actually, they need a microscope to see them. Now, the dilemma for evolution is that you have these radio halos in granite, but they're due to elements that decay very quickly. Now, the problem for the evolution is how do you get these elements forming, moving into these spots in such a time before they would decay too quick before they got there. Yet clearly, you've got these halos due to these very fast decaying elements, like these isotopes of polonium, or what you call there, and that seems to be a very strong evidence of rapid formation. I don't think it's Robert Gentry was the one who wrote about these, and he published in Nature, and he published in Science, and Annals of Nuclear Physics on all these things. But I think some of these halos are in rocks which are clearly post-flood rocks. They're not creation rocks. So what it does seem to show is rapid formation. And also in wood, coalified wood has these halos, and you've got these quite interesting things where you have a spherical halo and you have these elliptical halos supporting a very rapid compression of the wood to compress the spheres into ellipses. When you have a combination of the sphere and the ellipse in one concentric thing, it shows that you've had very rapid formation of this coal and rapid compression of this coal, and again, it cuts against the millions of year timescale. Okay, so if I find out more on our website, if you want to do it for free, or find out in Refuting Compromise on this. It's an interesting issue, that one. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'd like to hear your opinion on continental drift.
Mm-hmm. Well, continental drift is in chapter 11 of the Answers book. Yeah, I think it's actually not continental drift. I think it's more like continental sprint. You see, Dr. John Baumgartner, who's a PhD geophysicist, he's written a supercomputer program on a model of plate tectonics, and the evolutionists respect that model. As even though he's a creationist, the evolutionists respect that model. And what he has proposed is a much faster process that happens. So not the way we're seeing it now, but a very fast process where you have a slab of dense material on a slab of not-so-dense material, and it sinks below, it's called subduction, it sinks below the part. So it sinks and it dries and it pulls the rest of the plate along with it. So you have a very rapid continental drift or continental sprint happening that way. And the thing is also, the minerals tend to weaken drastically under high temperatures. So what you have, it's moving, it causes friction, so it weakens the material, so it moves even faster and causes even more friction, which causes even more heating and weakening, and so on. So you get a runaway subduction, is his model. And one evidence he uses for that is that some of the subducted plates in the mantle are still quite cold and haven't had a chance to warm up to the surrounding mantle temperature, and that seems to indicate they haven't been there that long. Well, under the slow and gradual model, they should have had plenty of time to warm up to that surrounding temperature. That seems to explain a lot of things that the slow and gradual model can't explain.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. And there's also a section on our a Q&A section on our website about plate tectonics as well. Okay. Yes, sir.
As Christians, we are already being persecuted these days because we are bombarded by the promulgation of the hoax. There is almost no document that you can pick up these days, whether a newspaper, whether a document from the federal government, from the provincial government, even from the municipalities, mm-hmm. that assumes that the evolution and, of course, its conclusion, which is this environmental thing regarding climate gate and things like that and so on. And my question is, how does one deflate it when you read, when you hear something, yeah, millions of years? Oh. Do you say nonsense? Do you say stop there? Do you just grin and bear it?
Well, I mean, the question is, how do you deal with all the propaganda? Well, one thing is to get informed, okay? It's not enough to say it's wrong. You must know why it's wrong, okay? And that's why we have these resources here, to help you get informed about the truth so you can actually more effectively argue the truth. And often, you might find the best thing is this, what we call the Socratic method. You ask some questions. They claim it's millions of years. Well, how do you know it's millions of years? So to make them realize how little they really know about something, they seem to be accepting it on faith rather than because of investigating evidence. What assumptions are they making? So if you ask the right sort of questions, you might be able to get them to question their own certainty in their faith in evolution in millions of years, rather than necessarily giving them the information. You have the information to back up, but you ask the questions of them. And that might undermine them.
It's almost impossible.
Oh, yeah, well, it's that too. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I'm a second-year university student, mm-hmm. and so in university, because I go to a secular university, Simon Fraser.
I went to one of those, too, yeah.
Yeah. So you get a lot of indoctrination, as you said, about Darwinism and all that stuff. And I guess the question that I have right now, I'm actually doing a research paper on it, is what's your take on, like, the mind-body problem or the mind-brain problem?
Because they're saying that. Yeah, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because the evolutionists say that the mind is just an epiphenomenon of the brain. That's the sort of thing. But the thing is, I think that review has a problem, because then why should you trust that thought to be true? If in fact, thought is just a result of the motions of atoms in the brain, why should we trust them? I mean, why should their brains be better than mine? Because our brains both work by the same laws of chemistry. I mean, how can they call themselves free thinkers if their thoughts are totally determined by the fixed motions of atoms in the brain? You see, I think it's a problem. I think just to point out the self-refuting nature of their view. And it's almost like, I remember even my secular university, one of the philosophy professors was talking about these sort of things. It's almost like he assumes there's no such thing as the spiritual, and then he used that as evidence against the spiritual, but first he's actually assuming what he has to prove. And that's what a lot of this mind-body stuff is doing, is assuming that mind is just an illusion, but they haven't really proven that. And there are some, I think people like Sir John Eccles, one of the leading neuroscientists in the world who got a Nobel Prize, he was very much against the idea that the mind was just a product of the brain and had no independent value. And same with consciousness. I mean, why, if that has no independent value, why would natural selection select for consciousness if it didn't really exist? So have a look on our website. We've got a few things. It's not really our specialty. We've got a few things about the brain and consciousness after death, and claims like the God spot in the brain. And a really nice, interesting John Cleese cartoon, actually, you might find on YouTube, where he's talking about all these scientists who believe there are parts in your brain that produce religious belief and all that. And then John Cleese says, well, here's the spot in the brain that produces the belief that all our thought is produced by the brain. He does better than I can, because he's a comedian. So our website might have some good things there.
All right. Thank you.
That's all right. Well, especially with the project, too. Yes, sir.
Good evening. Thank you, Doctor, for putting all your effort and coming out tonight. I'm not sure if I have a question or if it's more of a comment. It seems that there's a constant tug of war between science and religion, whereas we need to remember that science is merely a process, which is something that all humans are able to utilize.
Mm-hmm.
And religion is merely man's relationship or human's relationship with God, right?
Well, no. This idea of a conflict between religion and science is a 19th century humanist myth. Because as I pointed out, I did my talk this afternoon. In fact, it was quite the opposite of a conflict. It was, in fact, the Christian worldview that led to modern science in the first place. And most of the time, it's these silly arguments are produced, like the Galileo affair, for instance, which is more about science versus science than science versus religion. Because what Galileo's main opponents were the Aristotelians at the universities. They're the ones who taught this dogmatic geocentric view that Galileo was against, you see. To say it was the science, Galileo versus the church, is just a complete oversimplification of the issue. And again, that's on our website as well. And the main thing now, of course, is the evolution versus the Christianity. But I don't think evolution is really science, though. So that's not science versus religion at all. In fact, what it really is the scientific arguments for atheism versus the scientific arguments for Christianity more than anything else.
Thank you. And I think we need to also remember that accepting evolution seems to be very, a theory, seems to also coincide with giving all authority to governments. And these governments don't like creation because it means there's a higher authority that they need to be accountable to.
Well, it's no accident. A lot of the worst regimes of the 20th century were dogmatic atheistic ones like the communists who killed 100 million people between them. And the Nazis were very much a strongly evolutionary philosophy too. And the thing is, as you say, tyrants don't like competition. And the thing is, if people can refer to a higher law, that is competition for the tyrant who wants to make himself God. And that is a real problem. The thing is, everyone wants to make something God. If it's not the real true God, then there's a counterfeit, whether it's the state or money or whatever. It's not going to be good. And I do worry about the way that the government has become more of a god over the last century. I just want to mention this video here. This one here, called the Evolution and the Holocaust, might be relevant to that sort of claim. Yes, sir.
Just an item that might help
Sorry, can I hear you? Say again, please, sorry.
Hey, pardon?
You're very tall, I think.
Sorry. Yeah, okay. just an item that might help some of our young scientists here who are trying to reconcile science and God. Quick question for them and for all of us, perhaps. In some recent research, I found out that it takes approximately 10,000 quadrillion atoms per second just to develop our new red blood cells that have to be replaced about every 120 days. So here's 10,000 quadrillion atoms per second being sorted, selected, assembled into new red blood cells and delivered. And I feel that really reflects a lot of, not just science, but a lot of care from a supernatural force, which we call God in the English-speaking world. So should this help some of these young scientists
to
reconcile?
The thing is, the creative acts were finished on day six. I think what you've got here is God upholding things, and I think God has designed the machinery right at creation week, and all we're seeing is a continuation. As I say, the machinery works by natural laws. I'm sure of that. I mean, that's why I support scientific research. I don't believe you have to say that God is doing something specifically to make the red blood cells form, but he designed the machinery that does it. And you want to say, you might say God is working by his upholding rather than his creating activity. Because, I mean, it says that Jesus is the one who upholds the whole creation by the word of his power. That's what's happening now. Yeah, but the creative act is not happening, I think.
It's not just the construction, it's the maintenance and repair that has to be.
Maintenance is an important thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So the designer, however he is accomplishing this, is working very hard for each one of us. Mm. And I hope that is helpful to the young scientists that need to reconcile God with science.
Okay, thank you. Yes, sir.
Evolution has a lot of really difficult questions that they need to answer, and many almost impossible. But I'm wondering What would you consider the hardest question that creationists have to face?
Well, I don't know. The evolutionists come up with one. I won't do their homework for them.
Is there nothing that makes you
wonder
that, or something that needs more research?
There's always things that need more research, but I think a lot of the recent creation of research has been very good at solving. Like you have the rate project, which seems to have solved a lot of the mystery of the radiometric dating. You have John Hartnett's work on cosmology to solve the distant starlight problem. You have John Sanford and various people working on genetics to solve certain problems in genetics. You have the recent research on things like the splicing code, finding all these amazing functions in the so-called junk DNA. So really now we know that at least 97% of DNA is used for something, even though it may not be used for protein coding. So a lot of recent research in the last 10 years has become very helpful in solving problems that we probably didn't have a real good answer for even 10 years ago. But I mean, here's a bit of double standards from the evolutionists. You see, if I show a problem for an evolutionist, it's more, the whole point of science is to answer these sorts of questions, you see. But if they find a problem with creation, well, somehow we're supposed to give up and go home. Well, surely you allow the same, should give the creationists the same sort of allowance as the evolutionists want for themselves. Okay?
Yeah. Do you have an area of science relating to creationism that you're watching closely, that you're really most interested in the developments in that area?
I'm not really sure, actually, because I'm a chemist, you see. I'm not sure. I think the chemistry area is something which is very, very strong in our favor, because natural origin of life from chemicals just doesn't make any sense. And every time I see a new paper supposing to find it, it's very easy to knock holes in it. I've got geneticists and geologists colleague working on things which might be a bit more interesting.
Thanks.
Okay.
The scientific community talk a lot about objectivity and peer review that's been mentioned tonight. I'm just wondering why it is that in the public education system we're not addressing the two-model approach. You know, why is it that in schools, I'm a public school teacher, I've been one for 20 years now, and yet I am absolutely muzzled as a Christian to talk about a lot of the very academic and cognitive things that you have referenced tonight. And I'm just wondering, you know, if we are so impartial, why is it that we are not presenting both models in our textbooks at school?
They don't want to see both models. You see, Eugenie Scott is the leader of the national a so-called National Center of Science Education, which is just an evolutionary pushing view. It doesn't teach physics or chemistry. It's only devoted to attacking creation and keeping evolution in the schools. But even she said, well, if they're exposed to both models, they might end up rejecting evolution.
Yeah. So as one evolutionist said to the other, keep the faith.
Pretty much. Yes, sir. Maybe we'll make this the last question. It's getting a bit late, isn't it?
So Thank you. I was wondering if there's a biblical view we should have of genetically modified organisms.
Okay. I've got a slide on that somewhere. Let me find it for you. I'd say genetically modified organisms have their place, I believe, because man is given dominion over other creatures. You see, man is not given dominion over other men. That's why slavery is so evil, because it's actually taking man as a dominion over man. That's not allowed. But when it comes to dominion over other animals, in principle, it's okay, that sort of thing, genetically modified food. Just that there are some cautions in it. Now, see, if you have... not quite what I wanted, near enough. See, if you believe in evolution, you think that things got here by time and chance and natural selection. So maybe with our brains, we can improve on what has got here by time and chance, okay? But if you believe that things have been created, you might think, well, maybe we've got to be a bit cautious about trying to modify what's probably actually quite a good system the way it is. And therefore, I'd say, in principle, it's acceptable. In practice, I would just urge a bit of caution, you see, because here's some problems with it. And one thing that is, you can talk about making the right protein. I talked about making the proteins from a DNA code, but it's also the environment of the protein. You see, when they tried to make a blue rose from the hydrangea pigment, they didn't realize it was actually an acid-base indicator like litmus. And the rose had the wrong pH, so it had a different color. But there are some possibilities, you see, like if you can build a disease-resistant plant and that might grow crops that might save lives and prevent starvation, I don't see any problem with that in principle of having these sorts of genetically modified organisms if they will help people rather than harm people. We have a video on that. I think it's called Frankenstein Foods and Fetuses, which is all about genetically modified food and the pluses and minuses of it. Okay, well, thanks for listening to me. I hope you had a good time. Just a good time to stop the... Yeah, I can probably be around for a little bit anyway, but I just give you guys a chance to head home. I know it's quite late. And it's late for me because, I mean, we're it's after midnight my time, and I was up at 5 in the morning my time, and it's now 12:40 my time, so I'll be grateful. Thank you.